Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.
With everything going on with vaccines, I thought it would be a good idea for us to just throw out there what we know. I know Dr. Eber can't be on the call today. I don't think, I haven't seen Renee Marquardt. I don't think she's on the call, but they are the two physicians that have been on the one of the sub-task forces of our strike force interested in vaccine. So I will let you know where we're headed, what you can expect, and what the next steps are. And answer a few questions that I got ahead of time about vaccine, and we'll go from there and then just open it up. I think, so here's what's going on with vaccine. Prior to this week, the plan was for healthcare workers, including long-term care healthcare workers, to be prioritized into group 1A, and for long-term care residents to be prioritized as group 1C. The plan with the residents was for vaccine, which you know that the two messenger RNA vaccines have to be kept in very cold storage, the Pfizer at minus 80, the Moderna about 4 degrees below zero, which is really beyond the capability of our facilities. So the plan was for residents to have the pharmacists that get it from CVS and Walgreens primarily, get the vaccine, schedule appointments, come out to long-term care and vaccinate residents. The plan for staff was to have them go out to a vaccine center and get vaccinated. We argued, there were a number of states, including ours, that sent sort of friends of the court brief type things to the ACIP saying, we're worried about that because we already think only about half of our staff are going to be willing to be vaccinated. And the other half, if they have to drive across town and find a place to park and maybe pay for parking, and then find out, you know, they're going to find out where the vaccine is because it's going to be the 3 or 4 hour line waiting to get vaccinated. They're just not going to get vaccinated. So on Tuesday this week, the ACIP met. And one of the things they did was that will resolve at least that problem is they moved residents from 1C up to 1A. So they're now part of the 1A group, which allows us now not to have to either provide our own vaccine on site or send staff out to get vaccinated and just hope they follow. What we'll have now is pharmacists that will come out and do staff and residents at the same time. So that was huge news. It's really good. The December 10th, I believe the ACIP will vote to actually then approve or not the Pfizer vaccine, and all indications are it will be overwhelmingly approved. I believe they've set the 17th as the date to consider the Moderna approval. From the time that they approve it until it starts being distributed would be days or a week. It could get to Colorado as early as 2 weeks from now, more likely closer to 3 weeks from now. And once it gets here, then of course there's the whole distribution and scheduling and all that. So it really depends on how quickly CVS and Walgreens can get that going once it gets here. We are gonna do, I would encourage everybody on this call, and I'll tell you that we're doing everything we can to get as much information into CVS or Walgreens, depending on which we're using in any given facility, getting them the information as soon as possible so that we can get on the schedule early. With that, the biggest thing that all of us on this call and anybody else I can reach out to can do in the coming weeks is start understanding exactly why you want this vaccine and why you want everybody on your staff to get vaccinated. There's not going to be any mandated vaccination, at least not now. which is fine. You know, we may get to a point in the general public if too few people take it, but not now. So let me just go through a few more things about the vaccine. Some of these, thank you, David Shepherd, for sending a lot of these to me. Can you help? First question he has, can you tell if you have a false positive COVID result? If it's antigen, yes, you can hurry and send a PCR. If it's PCR and you just, it's a standalone result, no, there really is not a way, a practical way to find out that it's false positive. You can use some inference. We've had two cases in the past week, all PCR testing, where we've had negative, positive, negative, all in a period of 5 days, 6 days. And I would tell you that just, that doesn't happen. The positive in the middle had to be false positive. You don't get positive PCR that only lasts a day or two. So the reality is, no, there's, you can infer things, but it's not something we can easily prove. His next question, should people with a history of Guillain-Barré from influenza or other causes get COVID vaccine? The answer is absolutely yes. The whole Guillain-Barré story with influenza vaccine is worth a whole lecture, but it turns out that vaccine is probably even there protective against Guillain-Barré. Is anyone using remdesivir in nursing homes? The answer is no, and not because it couldn't be used, but because it's just not available. There is just, we've had a couple people try to order it. Pharmacies can't get it, so they can't deliver it. Does vitamin D, C, and zinc really help? Should we be using this, using these vitamin C and zinc? There's absolutely zero evidence that they're beneficial. Vitamin D, there is some really weak evidence that it would have minor protective capabilities. I think the reason to use vitamin D is based on the old data from the early 2000s about reducing falls and fractures. It doesn't really have side effects. So I think vitamin D is a good choice anyway. I don't think you use any of these to try to prevent COVID. It's taking a garden hose to a forest fire. Next, should nursing home staff from an individual facility all be vaccinated at the same time? Okay, so vaccination, the answer, simple answer to that is no. When we're scheduling these, we're gonna try to stagger vaccination schedule so we can do it a week apart for the staff. There is a 5 to 10% incidence of, headache, fatigue, myalgia, fever, which are exactly the kind of things we're screening for at the front door to tell people to go home. They're much more common after the booster dose than after the first dose, but you can have, in the first dose, it looks like it's about 1.5%. After the second dose, it may be 5 to 7 or 10%, depending on which study, Pfizer or Moderna. So we are probably gonna try to stagger vaccination of staff so that we don't suddenly have 5 or 10% of our staff the next day being sent back home as we screen them. For residents, yeah, vaccinate them all at the same time. Just get it done, get them started. We won't be vaccinating anybody that's had COVID in the previous 90 days. Anybody that's had COVID prior to that, there's not a recommendation yet. I think people are afraid to make it. And if there are two sides, I land on the side of those are not people that I would prioritize vaccinating, which we can talk about if you want to talk about how long immunity lasts and what we know of it in a few minutes. But I would prioritize the vaccine for anybody that has not had COVID yet. Okay, so that's all of David's questions. Couple other things, most of the trials left out pregnant women, people under 18, nursing home patients. Are those reasons for us to be worried? Not really. The pregnancy that with, even just with the two trials that are underway right, or that are about to be approved, the Moderna, Pfizer, just over 70,000 people enrolled. Some of those people, being pregnant was an exclusion to getting in, But the estimate is that there are somewhere in the hundreds of people that enrolled in the trial and whoops, ended up pregnant. So there will be some pregnancy data. 2 days ago, I think Moderna, and yesterday Pfizer applied to drop to age 16 and then finally to age 12. So they're going to start enrolling kids. So we should, and that'll be about 3,000 people in each trial. So we'll have some of that data soon. What else can I tell you about the vaccine? Immunity, I get that question a lot. How long will immunity last? Couple things. I don't think it's going to be like influenza. Influenza as a segmented RNA virus is undergoing mutations every day. There are just lots of, which is why we get the annual vaccine, that, and there's a whole science behind why that happens. Single-stranded RNA vaccines like coronavirus tend to have longer lasting immunity. My best guess, 18 to 24 months is about when we'll see enough of a drift away from the original that we'll have to give boosters or a new vaccine. Probably more along the line of booster than new vaccine, just given the changes that happen are pretty minor. Reinfections, I get a lot of questions about that as well. There is a European group that does sort of like Hopkins tracks all the cases around the world. There's a European group that does nothing but track reinfections. I almost sent these out, but I thought that they're pretty dry reading and nobody would look at them anyway. There's some criteria for what makes something a reinfection. Number one, you have to have both the original and the later positive swab, so that you can check genetic sequencing. And then once you have the genetic sequencing, chances are excellent. They're not going to be the same virus, but how much they've moved will tell you whether or not there's a mathematical model for figuring out whether or not there's actually different infections and your immune system would see them as different infections. 24 cases, documented cases of reinfection around the world as of early last week. I don't think since we've started rechecking everybody 90 days and more out, just in Vivage facilities, we've identified about 20 people that are positive more than 90 days out. I don't think if there's 24 in the world that we have the next 20 here in Colorado. So these are not, and none of these 20 are symptomatic. I think that these are all just continuing to shed virus, especially people that are older, obese or smokers, bad lungs. I think once you destroy virus, you just collect a lot of it in the bases of your lungs and you continue to try to excrete that over long periods of time. Okay, boy, sorry, I told you this was disorganized and I apologize for that. Oh, antibody, let me just touch on that real quickly. The Lilly antibody that's now available for infusion. We signed a contract with Lilly. We have been doing infusions of antibody as part of a prevention trial. That trial has been put on hold as vaccines become available. But we have also 2 weeks ago signed an arm to that that will look at treatment instead of prevention. So that as of December 10th, in our Vivage facilities, we will be able, if we identify somebody that knew COVID positive, we can get in touch with Lilly, have them come out and do an infusion of neutralizing antibody. It's actually a three-way trial. There are two different formulations of the neutralizing antibody in one formulation that's placebo. Because this is research, we won't know which one they're getting, but at least there's a 2 in 3 chance they get antibody. There was an EUA given for the antibody a couple weeks ago, so it's sort of available, although it's in limited supply. So in Colorado, if you want to get it, And I didn't send this out because I didn't have it when I sent the invite out. But there is a way that you can try to get it. You have to actually go on the portal. There's a health department portal link that I'll give to you. You go on this portal, you enter some information about the patient, when they were positive, has to be PCR, name, and so forth. And it has a randomizer, and within minutes, it shoots a response back to you that says, your patient has been approved. Here are some infusion sites where they can go to get the antibody infusion, or it sends a note back says, sorry, your patient was randomized in the group that won't get the antibody. So it's more like a lottery to see if you get it. And I don't know how it works or how many people get it, but it makes me feel ethically a little bit better about enrolling people in a trial where there's a 1 in 3 chance you won't get it. With a randomizer, I don't know what the chances are, but I think it's probably close to 50-50, whether you get it or not. So we are considering, and will probably within the next week or 10 days, opening on the west side of town in one of our facilities, an antibody infusion unit in one of the facilities where it will have its own entrance and exit. So COVID positive people won't have to mix with the rest of the population. For us, it will primarily be for staff, because when we identify new staff that are positive, we're going to recommend that they consider this, still have to sign a consent, but they could go there and have it infused. We will probably, depending on how this works and if it works, open it up to outside Vivage. For residents, they'll get it on site, whatever facility they're in. Okay, a couple more questions from Yvonne. What about continued, I don't know what TEDting is. Testing. What about continued testing? Yes. That's going to get really confusing as we start giving vaccine. Yet to be determined. The plan is masks and PPE will continue probably most of 2021. Testing, for now, it's going to continue until we're told not to. Because I'm one of the people that didn't trust curative labs, I didn't trust the data they initially sent us about their test. So we are, I'm actually in a call later today talking to CSU again. We are going to do a limited amount of research where we will concurrently test PCR, send one test, one swab to curative and one swab to CSU. They'll both do PCR testing on the same people in two or three facilities for several weeks, and we'll compare results. And I think the biggest difference we're going to find is, I think curative, we're going to have a lot more false positives. And the main reason behind it is that when they test, there are three different assays that CSU is doing for every person. When two of those three are positive, they count it as a positive PCR. Curative is only doing the N, as in Nancy, assay. So when they have just one positive, they count it as positive. When we did our research earlier this year, that we found about 3% of people were positive on one test, but not the other two. We had the luxury of knowing we were going to test them again the next week. We called those people negative, but continued to test every week. None of those people that we looked at over the 3 months we were doing the study came back the next week with three positives in turn COVID positive. What about testing after vaccination? That's a tough question. I don't think we're going to do any testing routinely. On the research side, I think there will be research done. Antibodies are unreliable because we don't know which antibody or what titer is protective. I think the money as we go forward is going to be in looking at B and T memory cells and finding a way to identify increases in B and T memory cells to COVID-19. And that's where the that's the pot of gold. So I would venture to say that by February, March, April, because there'll be so much interest in that, that there will be testing available in that regard, and that could be valuable. CDC quarantine guidelines, no, changed, yes, 14 to 10 days. And actually, if you, so this is Jeff pointed that out. In talking to April Burdorf and Rachel Hurley at the health department, that 14 to 10 only applies in the outpatient community and only to people with significant exposure. In nursing homes, the patients that come in from the hospital or patients that are positive, patients that are presumed positive, will continue to be 14 days. Staff have always been 10 days out, and then they can come back to work. So that 14 to 10 day shift that got a lot of press here a couple of days ago is going to have little or no effect in nursing homes. Okay, now I've finally run out of things to say. Questions on the chat line or come off mute, and we'll see what we can answer.
Managing your patients' needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
Hey, Greg, this is Mike Tobin.
Hello, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Out of breath.
Nice job. A question relating to the curative test.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, our agency has switched to only using the curative test and dropped our contract with CSU. So we aren't able to do the concurrent testing, which is what I was hoping to do. Any suggestions on how we move forwards with just using the curative testing?
Well, two things I tell you is one, hopefully with the research we're about to undertake with CSU, we'll have an answer in a few weeks about how accurate the test really is. Based on the original data that they sent to me and Dave Shepard, I thank you again, Dave, if you're on the call, separately did the same kinds of calculations. We came up with positive predictive values of about 18 to 20%, which makes it a lousy test, one in five chance it's positive. I think it's actually much better than that. My biggest other big issues with the curative test, if you do it correctly, you're supposed to come in the room with this patient, or a person that might be COVID positive. And as the person testing, you're supposed to say, cough vigorously five times while I just stand here. Thank you. And then you do the oral test, which has to hit seven different sites in the mouth. You can't have anything to eat or drink for 20 minutes or no medications, 20 minutes ahead of time. You do seven different sites. It's supposed to take a full 20 seconds to do it. I don't think it's going to work very well with the oral test. And especially older folks, I mean, when they did their statistics on the oral test, I'm sure it was 18 to 45-year-olds that drink Gatorade and water all day and have nice, moist mucous membranes. It wasn't 70-year-old demented people that want to slap you for putting something in their mouth and haven't had enough to drink today, so they got dry cheeks. And so what I would suggest is the swab that they give you works just as well doing a nasal swab as it does oral. I would just do nasal, stick with nasal. It may be more uncomfortable, but it's probably for the patients going to be more accurate. If you're going to do it with staff, make sure you do the full 20 seconds, get all seven sites that they tell you to get. And then we'll get back to you and let you know how accurate we think the results are.
Awesome.
And by the way, if you send it late in the week, Thursday, Friday, make sure that you tell UPS Saturday delivery. They don't deliver on Sunday anyway. But if you don't do that, it ends up on a truck. If it gets there on a Saturday, we had tests that went out last Wednesday that ended up in Kentucky on Monday and not yet been delivered. And then Tuesday ended up in California at the lab. And it was because it didn't say Saturday delivery. So that's just a little quirk.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Messenger RNA. Oh, so Mary asked, how do the messenger RNA vaccines work? They're the coolest thing ever. Most vaccines, viral vaccines, is the virus that's killed, it's obliterated, and then you separate out little tiny pieces of the outer shell, and you put that in serum, and it turns into vaccine so that you can develop antigens to the outside of the virus. If you look at my really nice picture behind my head, you'll see all the little orange things on the coronavirus that we're all used to seeing. The messenger RNA virus is so cool. These vaccines go in, and instead of going to the nucleus inside one of your respiratory cells and say, make copies of the virus, and we'll just then go make copies of the virus so that we can stimulate a response, all they do is go to the cytoplasm, they go to the ribosomes, and they turn on, this vaccine turns on the ribosome and tells it right then and there to make copies of just the spike protein. So you don't have to make any of the rest of the virus. All you do is make copies of the spike protein. It turns out most of those end up sort of just stuck on the inside of the cell, but a steady flow of them do make it outside the cell, where your immune system then has ready access to them, and then you get an immune response to spike proteins as they go on. One of the questions that hasn't been answered yet is, how long does that keep going? And by the way, in 1 minute, it's gonna be 1 o'clock. Anybody that needs to leave, feel free. I'll keep going as long as I'm answering questions. We don't know how long that messenger RNA will continue to make spike proteins. So it could be, you know, right now the guess is about 10 days, but that's based on a mouse model. We don't know in people. And that could make the vaccine even more effective, is that it may, for a prolonged period of time, continue to make low levels of spike protein, which again, don't confer infection. You can't get infected from a spike protein. So that's how that vaccine works. It's different. They've been trying to do this for about 20 years. They've tried it with other viruses, including influenza, and have never been able to get it to work. And then finally, it worked. And by the way, Moderna is mode RNA. That's how they got their name. It was based on modulating RNA virus like this. John Morrison, why not give vaccine to recent COVID cases, staff, and patients? The main reason is they're not going to be any more immune. The only way you get through COVID is if you have an appropriate immune response. With the natural disease, you have a full-blown response to, I mean, this isn't to say that it isn't possible that you might be a little bit more immune than you were, but not much. You're going to have antibodies, B cells, T cells, memory cells, as much as you're ever going to get after recently having COVID. If we get to the other reason not to do it is every time you vaccinate somebody that has had COVID in the recent past, and you presume they're already immune, every dose of vaccine that goes to them is a dose that can't go to somebody else out in the community that hasn't had COVID yet. So you slow down herd immunity and you put other people at risk by doing it. By next summer, we should have 100 million doses by end of April, early May, that could in the US. By July, we could have 200 million. So, you know, if we get to July and we still have this strangely uninformed, uneducated group of anti-vaxxers that are keeping hordes of people away, sure, go get revaccinated when there's excess vaccine and nobody wants it. Contraindications to vaccine, boy, none. I would tell you that historically, 99% or more of all side effects occur in the first 6 weeks after the vaccine is given. In the two trials that are about to be approved, the Moderna, the Pfizer, just over 70,000 people that are well over that six-week period now. In both studies, there's not a single serious adverse side effect. The worst adverse side effects are the ones we talked about, which are the ones that I tell people you want to have, fever, headache, fatigue, myalgia. You want those. You want to know, and those are more likely after the second one. You want to know your immune system is working and that it saw the antigen and responded and it did what it was supposed to do and gave you those side effects. So you do want those things to happen. Paul Offit was just saying that, yeah, with every vaccine, we never know all the serious side effects until not 50,000 or 100,000 people got it, but 10 million, 20 million. By the time we get through phase three, so all the high priority folks, so phase 1A we talked about, phase 1B is utility, police, fire, critical workers. And then there's phase two with older people at higher risk, and phase three. When we finish the first three phases about the end of March, early April, then we get to the general population. But by then, we should have anywhere from 20 to 50 million people who are more than 6 weeks out from vaccine. So we'll have a much bigger pool of people to look to see if there were side effects we didn't find. So for the general population, we'll know by then. I'll just tell you, that isn't going to slow me down. I still intend to be right at the front of the line. How long to develop an immune response? That just, again, after the second, for these two vaccines, after the 28 days when you get the second dose, 7 days later is when you should hit your peak for antibodies. Okay, other questions? Thank you, Steve Atkinson, for weighing in with a comment. Long time no see. Anybody else? I'll do what I can. Okay. Last takeaway is get people excited about getting vaccinated. If you get COVID, you know, if you're in a risk group, you have about 1.5 chances in 100 that you're going to die from it. You have about 1.5 chances in 100 that you're going to have a serious long-term chronic problem. If you get the vaccine, and it's like, even if it's just like every other vaccine, and right now it looks like it's safer, but if it were like every other vaccine, 1 chance in 1,000,000 that you might have something more serious. So it's a real simple equation. Travis, thank you. Clay, you were there. Thank you. Ethics meeting, which is in an hour, we are going to listen to or talk about the Paul Offit interview with Dr. Bachman from JAMA. And if I won't talk to most of you before then, happy holidays, happy new year, and we'll get back together in January. Thanks everybody for being on the call.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.